This is The View from 22 from The Spectator. Subscribe from just £1 a week at spectator.co.uk.
Hello and welcome to a special issue of The Spectator's podcast, sponsored by King and Wood Mallison. The Davos Summit is now over, and we're here to discuss the theme it raised, the fourth industrial revolution, whether the machines are going to take over the economy. And with me to discuss it are Ed Conway, the economics editor of Sky News, Simon Collins, the UK chairman of KPMG, and Stefan Kruger, partner at King & Wood Mallison. So I'd like to start by asking you, Simon, to explain what is meant by the fourth industrial revolution. Is it a theme that we can take seriously?
I think we have to take it seriously. The way I try and make sense of it is to look at three different things. The changing demographics of the world, so big population explosion, emerging middle class, lots more consumers. That's meeting two other things. First of all, this massive technological development, automation, digitization of everything. And thirdly, the millennial generation and what they're looking for in the workplace. And when you put all those things together, we've got a revolution in the potential demand for goods and services, revolution in the way they're supplied, and a social revolution as well about the way the workplace works.
Sounds fantastic.
Well, it means we have to take it seriously.
Yeah, sure. But are there, does this necessarily mean there's a problem? I mean, they're exploding middle class, lots of wealthy people, millennials, better educated than ever before. Technology means we've got lots of gadgets to improve our lives. So is there anything we should worry about?
Well, I think it depends whether you see the fourth industrial revolution as something that runs you over as a person or something that people can actually control and use for the benefit of society. So I think that's exactly the problem society has to solve, whether this is something that we're doing to ourselves that we're all going to look back and regret, sort of takeover of the machines or, you know, vast elimination of jobs, or whether it's going to be liberating, it's going to make people better off and more content in the workplace.
As Conway, we've heard quite a lot about the arrival of the machines. Is this actually something new? I mean, haven't we been worrying about this in some way or another since the Luddites protested against the spinning machines a couple of centuries ago? I mean, is there anything... Sure, the computers are new, but the general process, isn't this something as old as the Industrial Revolution itself?
Yeah, I agree. And the computer revolution, actually. So the fourth industrial revolution, the idea about there being a fourth industrial revolution... was something, I mean, it's been vaguely talked about for some time, but it's kind of coalesced around the World Economic Forum that just happened in Davos. I was there, lucky me. And when we arrived, we were given a book by Klaus Schwab, the man who runs it, called The Fourth Industrial Revolution, Why It's Going to Change Everything. And we all had a copy of this. And I read through it, and I'm afraid to say I wasn't that convinced. I mean, the idea, okay, is that you've got the Industrial Revolution, the first one that happened, that was a transport mechanical one. You've got the kind of mass production one, which is the kind of Henry Ford Industrial Revolution, that's the second. You've got the third one, which is the Computer Revolution in the 1960s. And then the idea is that kind of everything that's trendy in the world right now, AI, robotics, kind of Internet of Things, biotechnology, the genome, gets coalesced into what is called this fourth Industrial Revolution, which is supposedly going to change the world. And my experience in Davos was such that there was a moment that kind of encapsulated it. They had this robot that they brought over from South Korea called Hubo. This robot, which was the best thing, the newest kind of technology you can have in robotics, and it could actually kind of walk upstairs, which was very unusual for robots, and it could step into a car. It was like the newest thing in robotics. And so all of us kind of tried to step up and have a photo taken with Hubo. And you needed about three people to kind of hang Hubo's arm over you in order to do it. And then at various occasions it broke down. And it just struck me that, you know, yes, there are lots of these things happening. Yes, there's lots of creative destruction in the world right now. Yes, there are lots of challenges, as Simon's laid out. But the idea that we're at a turning point now, I'm just deeply sceptical about that.
So, Stefan Kruger, I mean, we may not be taking selfies with robots anytime soon, but are there aspects of this which you think are having a real-world impact on perhaps some of your clients?
Yeah, I think what Ed just mentioned is extremely important because it demonstrates, I think, that not everything that is part of the fourth revolution actually increases productivity. And I think some roboter who's able to walk on a stair doesn't necessarily have an impact on the economy. What always strikes me is that within the last 10 to 15 years, the computerization and so forth didn't really increase efficiency and productivity anywhere. So I think the big challenge for the fourth revolution is increase efficiency somehow. I think there is a very good prospect that that's going to happen. I mean, automated cars, for example, are certainly a large step forward. But in the past, the mere fact that we used computers, for example, didn't make us much more efficient. That's what the studies say. And from the legal profession, I can tell you, 20 years ago, an agreement was kicked back and forth two or three times because it was very burdensome to do it, because you've got to put your comments down by hand and so forth. Now an agreement is kicked back and forth, 10 or 15 times because of the computer. But did that increase in efficiency? It probably didn't.
For seven days,
good for lawyers though.
Yeah, it's a lawyer's thing.
I will confess, new to me, the idea that computers haven't increased our productivity. I imagine many people listening to this podcast will be a bit surprised by that and thinking of the many ways that personal computers have vastly expanded the number of things that they can do in a fraction of the time it would have taken them to have done 20, 30 years ago.
Right. It is surprising. But I read a couple of studies saying that the efficiency in the workplace, and you're probably much better equipped to talk about that than I am, but the efficiency in the workplace didn't increase through computers.
So what did it increase through then? We've had productivity growth of about 2% for quite some time. So what's driving this, if not the technology at our disposal? I thought this was part of the way that economies expand. People invent clever things, they manage to do things a bit faster, a bit cheaper.
Exactly.
But
exactly.
You're saying computers is not part of that story so far.
I think that's right. And that's why I'm saying it's the big challenge for the fourth revolution to actually increase efficiency. And when you think about the impact of the fourth industrial revolution and the way it can actually be a good thing for an economy and not only for a few, I think you have to think about increasing the efficiency. If that's possible, if you can increase efficiency, I think it will be good for everyone. If you can't, there will be a few winners and many losers.
Simon Collins, this is, of course, the concern people raise, that yes, the technology will make things very efficient for a certain number of people, perhaps people working for KPMG, but there will be losers as well as winners. Is that something that you perceive, that there's a flip side to all of this, and there will be a lot of people who will struggle to find themselves finding a job in the way they might have done when there was so much lower skilled work around?
I think that is the politician's dilemma here, if you like, because I think on an individual basis, there have to be losers. I mean, technology is crowding out the lower end of the labour market. It's actually replacing some boring, repetitive tasks. We see it in lots of different industries. But overall, my sense and the evidence for me points to the fact that actually that is making a bigger cake. It's how it's carved up as we enter into this fourth
industrial. And in Britain, employment is at a record high. There isn't much evidence in this country anyway that these machines have rendered lots of more people on the door.
No, but I think it's masking another thing, because if I look at our experience, we employ lots of people. We are embracing mechanisation, automation as much as we possibly can, but in two different ways. One is actually crowding out some things that have previously been done in a labour-intensive way, so that potentially threatens jobs. The other thing, though, is it's actually opening up whole new avenues of things we can do. If I look at analytics, we can actually use analytics across all the data that our clients produce. We can help them see around corners in terms of forecasting. We can give better audit opinions as a result of using analytics. So that means we're actually doing a lot more. In the process of that, we take on more people at increasing skill levels. But that doesn't mean they're always the same people. That's why I think as a societal dilemma, we will have losers. As society overall, I think, will benefit.
Ed Conway, the impact of all this unemployment has been something which has baffled economists in Britain over the last few years. I mean, the job creation rate in Britain has really exceeded all of the expectations of pretty much any forecaster that there is. So, I mean, is it the case that something is going badly right here? What's Britain doing right?
I don't know. I mean, it's a puzzle why employment has risen so fast. And like you say, it's the highest level, even as a percentage of the population that we've got on record.
Mm. Wages haven't, which may be
but wages haven't, and that goes back to what Stefan was saying about productivity. And it doesn't. It is odd. It's good news that we've come out of this depression. In comparison to the 1930s, you haven't seen unemployment kind of go through the roof, at least in the UK and the US. In Europe, it's a different story. In parts of Europe, not Germany, yeah. but many parts of the Mediterranean. But yet you haven't seen the bang for buck that you're getting. So per hour worked, the productivity just hasn't recovered, hasn't kind of gone up in the way that it did after previous recessions. It might be demographic reasons. There's a whole host of things. But to bounce off what Stefan was saying, you know, the previous industrial revolution, if we're calling these things industrial revolutions, so, you know, the 1950s when it was this great era of the consumer, the golden era of the consumer, lots of kind of fridges, your life being transformed by air conditioning, all of that stuff happening, driving, you know, mass production of cars, you saw total factor productivity go up by about 3.5% in the 1950s. And throughout that kind of period, from 1930 to 1970, it was going up about 2 to 3%. And now, since then, it's just been 0.5%, despite the internet, despite the kind of, you know, everyone having smartphones. And either we're just not measuring it right, and I wonder whether there might be something in that. So how do you measure the success of Amazon and the kind of benefits to people?
Because nobody pays for Google, it makes your life easier. So exactly. Is that giving us a benefit which isn't showing up on the
Precisely,
figures?
Yeah. And you're working longer, so you always have your iPhone or your BlackBerry or whatever it is at home. Therefore, you're always at work, for better or for worse. And yet that doesn't show up in the figures. So perhaps we're not measuring it well, but looking at the numbers, you know, actually, right now is a really interesting time because you've got a lot of people saying that we are, you know, it's the end of the golden era of American and Western growth. And you've got other people saying that this is a great moment where, you know, these machines are going to kind of change the world.
Well, on the subject of America, of course, we are, because it's the presidential election season, so we're hearing about the end of America quite a lot now. But it is the case that there are some states in the US where you go to order a burger and a machine will serve it to you. Not something we've seen in this country yet, but is this a sign of things to come? And should we be worried?
I'm sure it is. And as long as we handle this problem in a smart way, I think it's a good thing. Because generally, there's no upside for an economy to have jobs like, well, handing out burgers done by a human. That's not necessary, as long as, and that's the important point, as long as there are other jobs for the people who previously sold the burgers. And I think that's the real challenge of the fourth industrial revolution, to educate people in order to enable them to do other jobs which require a higher level of skills or education or what have you.
But that's just an argument for young people, Stefan Kruger, but there will be lots of people who are, I don't know, 30, 40 years old of lower skill set. Harder to re-educate them, isn't it?
It may be harder, but that's one of the challenges. I think this lifelong learning concept is extremely important. I mean, one of the good things about the computerization is that there are now many different ways to educate people. It's no longer the classroom where there's a teacher in front of the class and people are listening. There are so many different ways to educate people to have a computer program or at least computer support when educating people and educating them exactly the stuff they need for their next job. I think that's a big opportunity, and I think you're right, especially with regard to people who are 30 or 35 or maybe even older. That is one of the challenges, to make them change their mind in that regard, that they have to be educated again.
Yeah. Now, Simon Collins, the places in America that do have machines selling you burgers tend to be states with high minimum wages. Now, we can argue about the effect of automation, but what we know for sure is that the higher you raise a minimum wage, you render unemployed those whose skills are not worth the amount. And in Britain, we're about to embark on a very high minimum wage, above £9 an hour. Now, according to the government's forecast, that's going to leave something like 60,000 more people on the dole. Is that not the greater threat to lower skilled workers, that the government is effectively going to price them out of the market? It's not the machines, it's the government we should be worried about.
So for an individual, in the short term, I think that's true. It is a threat. I take a different view, though. I take the view that actually, if you set a sort of economic wage, something that people can actually live on, rather than something that's a market determined only, then actually you end up crowding out the tasks that can be done by machines. You end up reinvesting a society. These need active decisions to manage them. But pay a living wage, so you don't need a state subsidy subsidizing employers for underpaying based on the market. You reinvest in education, and actually you get a much better whole picture. But it does require political intervention as well as just, you know, you can't just put the minimum wage up. You've also got to reinvest the proceeds in re-education and work with employers.
Of course, but what happens to those who will struggle to get a job at £9 an hour because their skills do not command that sort of money?
Well, in aggregate, they get reskilled to command £9 an hour because society prices out those jobs that don't do it with automation,
right,
and everybody trades up.
Ed Conway, this isn't an argument we hear much in politics because there's a consensus behind the minimum wage, but do you think that the minimum wage coming hand in hand with technological advance could be something which makes life really difficult for those who drop out of school at 16? I mean, it's still a significant number of people in Britain do that with no real numeracy literacy skills to the standard required. It's tough for them now. It's going to be even tougher, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think once you lose your job, particularly, or for instance, are just unable to get a job for a period of 18 months to 2 years, it just becomes proportionally far more difficult to actually find a job in the long run. So you end up going into long-term unemployment. But you know, as Simon was saying, there's a phenomenon here, which is that, you know, left to their own devices, people don't seem to be earning enough, and therefore, over the course of the past two decades, the state has had to step in to top up their earnings. And that's basically what the majority of working welfare has become. You know, you have a job, you know, perhaps in a supermarket or somewhere, and the state steps in and helps you kind of top it up to something which is, you know, worth living on.
It's quite significant, isn't it? In terms of percentage of your salary, it can be about a third, sometimes 50%.
It can be enormous, yeah. And like, we have this conception, it's a misconception now, that benefits are all about being on the dole, you know, unemployment benefits. But the vast majority are not. It's for people in work. And, you know that here at The Spectator, and I'm sure kind of most of the listeners will, but most people who are kind of, you know, frustrated with the welfare system and desperately want it to be cut, a lot of people don't understand that actually this is something which is addressing a massive productivity crisis in the UK, which is that we do not generate enough money per hour worked. Up till now, the government has had to step in. It doesn't now have enough money to pay the welfare bills, and so it's trying to do something different, lifting things up with the living wage. But none of us know precisely how successful that's going to be, and for the reasons you're saying, you know, that people will struggle, you will have a rise in unemployment as a result of this, and no one knows whether you're kind of pushing at the rope rather than pulling at it, and no one's sure how effective that's going to be.
Stefan, can I ask you what industries you reckon are stand to benefit and which ones stand to lose from the trends that we're seeing?
Yeah, well, I think retail, in particular e-commerce retail, is benefiting from the Industrial Revolution a lot. I think that's for sure, and they're probably the first ones who see an uplift through big data, because you can pretty much predict what a certain consumer wants to buy. You can target him, you can send him targeted.
So better advertising through data.
Yeah, absolutely. The consumer becomes predictable through big data, and you know where he's living, and probably when you combine that data with, for example, his Facebook profile, you pretty much know what he's going to buy next, and then you can target him. And I think that's a real benefit that's already.
So it makes for more efficient advertising when they want to advertise their products
exactly,
to the right people.
Exactly. And that again increases the productivity and the profitability of any kind of website. If you can, for example, target your audience, and you know who they are and what they are going to buy or what interests they have, you can double or triple the money you earn by advertising.
Can I just say that the thing that frustrates me is whenever I see a targeted ad, I'm sure it's the same for people listening, it's invariably for something I've bought before and don't want to buy again. And so by the same token, I think there's a counter argument that says, you know, advertising hasn't necessarily become that much more sophisticated, mm-hmm. which is why so many people are frustrated with it and using ad blockers, which is a problem for, you know, for many journalistic organizations and other people. And, you know, again, it goes to this question of how much of these advances is genuinely improving productivity as opposed to just, you know, oiling the wheels that have been relatively well before.
Yeah, you're talking about not very sophisticated advertising, and I think that's right. It's getting on your nerves because you're getting the same offers every time you start your browser.
Can I ask anybody on this table had or seen a really clever advert that persuaded them to buy something they might not otherwise have done? No. See, isn't this the issue, Stefan? That it's there in theory. In theory, you can come up with very clever things. In theory, you can have a driverless car, but in practice, perhaps people just don't want to ride in a driverless car. The potentials are more dazzling than the progress.
Yeah, but I think, we're just at the very beginning of a discussion. Talking about driverless cars, the funny thing is, when you talk to people and ask them, would you buy a driverless car? People would usually say, no, I'm the best driver here. Especially when you're German, you think you're the best driver in the world. When you ask them, do you want the other people to drive a driverless car because then it's safer? People will say, yes, yeah, I don't want to have a lunatic on the autobahn not keeping the right distance behind me. And I think that's where we just have to get smarter. We have to understand that driverless cars, for example, are simply safer. We are not there yet. And the fourth industrial revolution will take time. There can be no doubt. But this is, I think, a very good example where people will just get more sophisticated, more educated, and recognize that it's a good thing to have a driverless car.
Simon Collins, is it always the case that technology drives demand? I mean, the Sinclair C5 was a great invention. Nobody wanted it then, nobody wanted it now. Concorde was an incredible invention. It was supersonic transatlantic travel, which basically was no longer used due to a lack of demand. So sometimes it doesn't matter what you invent. It doesn't always follow that people will want it.
No, it doesn't. But sometimes also those technologies leave behind more lasting benefits. So the research ends up with a product. The product may or may not sell, but actually it goes on to spawn a generation of new products. So there's some benefit from the pioneering of technology. The other thing, though, is I wonder whether we concentrate too much sometimes on the Concorde end of the market, the glamour end of the market, about what consumers want. And actually, I wonder whether the revolution is actually going to be sort of buried under the carpet, the plumbing of the world. So if you think about what the internet's done, it's facilitated things, it's created some of its own demand. You know, maybe the next generation will look at blockchain technology, Bitcoin and so on, as actually fundamentally changing the plumbing by which the world does transactions. Maybe the emerging populations of Southern Africa, China, India are going to skip whole generations of infrastructure around banking and retail and go straight to mobile and enable things. So it doesn't have to be a glamorous end product to be revolutionary in the way it opens up the world.
Right. And I also noticed that Simon Collins, you're not wearing an Apple iWatch. That's one piece of technology which has not appealed to you.
I have said progressively as each piece of Apple kit has come out that I can't see the point of it and I don't need it. And about 6 months later, I tend to adopt it enthusiastically. So next time.
Well, we'll see if there's a future there. Ed Conway, have you found a use for your Apple iWatch yet? Or is it just a glamorous piece of trinket?
It has changed my life in not one bit. It's. I mean, no, it's a nice watch. It tells the time pretty well, and it's got a stopwatch. But I mean, I believe you can get those on other watches as well.
So does it embody the fourth industrial revolution then? Something which could do great things.
Yeah, slightly disappointing. And you know, I keep coming back to this quote, Peter Thiel, the great kind of investor in Facebook, who said that we wanted flying cars and we got 140 characters. You know, it's inventions like Twitter and things like that. They have certainly improved communication around the world, but it is not the dream that we had about the future, and we're not really in that place. And driverless cars, I mean, fantastic to have a driverless car, but again, I don't think that is as great a leap as it was when cars themselves were invented. You know, the move from horse and carriage to cars, that was an enormous leap. The move from, you know, having to drive your own car to having someone else, a robot or whoever, drive it, I don't believe that is as great a leap in terms of productivity.
Okay. Stefan Kruger, we spoke about which industries stand to gain from this, but what about what countries? Do you think Germany, with its massive manufacturing base, stands to gain disproportionately from the advances in automation?
I think that's very difficult to say at this stage. I mean, we've been talking about driverless cars, and obviously Germany has some strong car manufacturers, and they will obviously benefit because people think about, I think, will think about driverless cars as soon as they are on the market. And with regard to what you just said, I think the driverless, I'm a big fan of driverless cars, I think that has become clear. But isn't that one very good example where efficiency actually increases? I'm always concerned about developments which do not increase efficiency. And here, we've got the perfect example of people being able to save time, starting to work when they leave home and stuff like that. That's why I'm fascinated about that kind of fourth industrial revolution, which increases efficiency.
So, Simon Collins, do you look forward to the day you can jump into a driverless car, or does something freak you out about the whole thing?
A bit of each. I mean, I like driving, and exactly what Stefan said resonates with me. If all the other idiots of the world can be put into driverless cars so they're kept out of my way, that would be the ideal situation. But so actually I'm really excited by, I'm not sure about driverless cars, but I think again it could be the example of the type of technology that helps us automate processes and get safer. So I'm excited by that. But there's a bit of a soulless bit to it too. It reminds me of Tomorrow's World in the 60s when I was growing up, confidently predicting that breakfast, lunch and dinner would be replaced by a pink, blue and green pill. Well, yeah, technically possible, but strips all the soul out of it. And what have we seen? We've actually seen people care more about food in the 21st century and preparing it and loving it than predicted.
But you know, the difference is that when people were watching Tomorrow's World in the 70s and 80s, you turned on to that program, if people were old enough to remember it, with a sense of excitement about the future. Now, when we look forward, we think, this is going to, we look forward with a greater sense of trepidation. The idea that this is going to create inequality, but this is going to create massive social cleavage problems that politicians are going to try to struggle to address. I mean, do you get that sense, Ed Conway, that people are worried about this because they think that technology has now stopped making things better and is about to make things socially worse?
Yeah, but I think I feel like that's been a constant theme, ever since the people's thoughts of mechanization, the machines have been seen as an enormous threat. And I think that perhaps we feel it more now because, there are some very obvious inventions that are changing many people's lives. But we've been through this before. And I think that, we will, as I think, both of fellow panelists were saying, if education improves enough, then people will be able to be retrained. The idea, though, that there's this kind of Malthusian idea that we're about to kind of come into this apocalyptic moment when everyone loses their jobs and we run out of food and the world comes to an end. To me, that seems a nice idea, and it's got a nice narrative to it. But in reality, every single time there's been a challenge like this, we have overcome it, whether with agriculture, whether with mechanisation. And we will find a way of seeking out employment for people. We'll create the goods, we'll create the demand as need be, so that people do have jobs, but one just hopes they're pleasant jobs to do. And it is better to not be flipping burgers if you can avoid doing it and do a different job as well. And so that's perhaps what the hope that we have.
Okay, well, maybe I can close by asking all of you how you expect automation to affect your own line of work in 15, 20 years' time. I mean, will you all be replaced by computers eventually? Let's start with you, Stefan Kruger. I mean, your industry has been relatively protected so far, hasn't it?
That's right, and it's very difficult to imagine that lawyers will be replaced by machines. I'm pretty sure that as far as some support work is concerned, like legal research and what have you, things will get easier and more efficient. But at the end of the day, somebody has to take a judgment, and I can't really imagine that this is done by a machine.
Simon Collins, KPMG got going to be transformed in 15, 20 years' time by these things?
I think it will be transformed. I think, we try and keep what I call the Kodak paranoia alive in the business.
What's that?
About seeing, feeling that you're right on top of your industry, you've got barriers to entry because you're the biggest producer of film, and digital isn't a threat until it's completely swallowed you. So I think you have to be paranoid about what technology can do and about what disruptors using technology can do. But I actually think it's like, I see it like an oil tanker. You can either get in its way, in which case you'll be run over, or you can ski behind it and actually use the technology to actually drive the business. So I think it will be transformed. It's our job to try and make sure that transformation is a positive one.
And Ed Conway, that robot you were laughing at in Davos, will it be doing your job one day?
I hope so. Probably doing a lot better than I can, frankly. Journalism is doomed, of course, isn't it? It's always doomed. But it's not really. I mean, I think, you know, this is a golden era for journalism. And all that's changed is the distribution channel. You know, it's coming out on an iPad or on the internet rather than being out on paper, which is probably a good thing for trees. And people, as they get more intelligent, as they get more interested in the fourth industrial revolution or whatever it is, they will want more opinions and analysis and news, and that's...
And podcasts.
Yes, I hope so.
Let's hope so. Ed Conway, Stephen Kruger, and Simon Collins, thank you very much.